This is Mae Warren. This is tape two with Sally Wyant, April 9th, 1996. And we're just talking about the jewel in the crown.
The jewel in the crown. That, well, obviously the expression comes from the title of a book, yes. But as it relates to us, it comes from one of our early Francis Lewis scholars in resident, Vic Rosenblum, who is a senior faculty member at Northwestern. He knew John Wilson before and became reacquainted while he was here. Vic had been president of, I believe, Reed College, which is
Oregon,
mm-hmm. which was about the same time that John Wilson had been president of Wells. And we were looking for, I think this was about the time that Roy had agreed to stay one more year in the deanship so that there would be a strong dean in the law school while John Wilson was in his first year in the presidency, so that not both the president of the university and the law dean would change at the same time. But Roy was clearly ready to retire from the rigors of being a dean. Most law deans now turn over every 3.9 years. Roy had been a dean for 15 years. Now that was in the era when law deans did last longer, but we were beginning this new era of deans that stay in the deanship approximately 5 years. And we were looking for a new dean. And John Wilson was talking with Vic Rosenblum about law schools and legal education and searching for deans and how law deans were different than deans of colleges. And we collectively were having a conversation when Vic was pointing out to John Wilson that the law school was the jewel in the crown. Very few universities in the country, particularly those that are primarily undergraduate liberal arts colleges, have law schools, let alone a law school with a national reputation, let alone the special kind of things that were happening in this building and what that meant as far as how a president looking for a new dean and working with the law faculty to find a new dean, how important it was for the university to maintain the jewel in the crown. And that sort of has stuck with us periodically.
Oh, it's lovely. And it's what makes us a university.
It is what makes us a university.
It is the jewel.
And it, yes, it is what makes us a university. And builds our reputation in circles that we would otherwise not be known.
Well, it's a lovely title. I really encourage you to use that as your title.
Sounds like a good plan to me.
I wish the title of the whole book would come out so easily. Let's go continue with this theme mm-hmm. of co-education. Did you get involved at all personally in bringing the undergraduate women in? Was your opinion solicited personally?
I was appointed to sit on a number of committees that looked at varying kinds of things. And then a committee that met very regularly, times about weekly at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I was involved in that capacity. I was often invited to participate in interviews as we were beginning to build a women faculty on the front campus, so that they would have a sense of talking with someone who had been here and what it might be like were they to join the university. So I was involved in that way. As far as actively involved in the admissions of co-ed classes, I was not.
Now, who would those faculty members have been who came as a result of those interviews?
Well, I'm trying to think of sort of some have come and gone,
mm-hmm.
You know, like Isabel McElwain and you know, talked regularly with Jean Dunbar in sort of early stages. There was a woman in the English department who was a James Joyce scholar and who actually started the Foreign Film Institute. I'm trying to think about women who have been here. And I was on the committee, but that was years later, that rehired Barbara Brown and persuaded her to return to the university. I'm just trying to think of some names of people who
I don't think of anybody who's been here a long time other than Pam and you.
And Nancy Margan.
Mm-hmm. I don't know her.
Nancy Margan is a senior woman faculty member in the psychology department. And she came after, she may have been on the faculty before I finished law school. I don't mm-hmm. remember exactly when Nancy came.
Right, yes, she has been here. But you, yes, and so she's been here longer than co-education.
Oh yes.
Well longer.
Yes, right. Very much so.
Now, you told me a really lovely story that I particularly liked last week about your graduation.
Oh, yes. Well, graduation from Washington and Lee, I think, is more special than graduations from most places to begin with. I mean, it is a very personal event, and we're small enough so that you can really feel a part of something. I had not gone through graduation for my master's degree. It was a large university where the school of whatever stands up, and I had announced to my parents that I would be delighted if they wanted to visit me, but I wasn't going to do that. So having deprived them out of that graduation, I did say that I would do as much of the graduation ceremonies as they were feeling so inclined, and that included graduation dance the evening before, which was a formal event. And I don't know when we stopped doing that. But I think probably the most touching event was for me to cross the podium to receive the congratulations from the president and my dean, and then be met by Jim Femister, who came from the faculty side where the faculty were seated, and to be escorted from the ranks of the student to join the faculty, where they had saved a seat for me. And that was very heartwarming for me, and I think the pleasure that it gave my parents was particularly touching. That was a high point.
Well, it is for me just hearing it.
Yeah.
But Jim Femister also said something that day.
Oh, he did. He pointed out that with my agreeing to join the faculty and with that moment, I had now doubled the number of faculty women in the law school, and that was a yet another occasion to celebrate.
And indeed, it really, that must have made a huge difference.
You know, by then we did have a number of women students. I don't know what our percentage was, but it was probably approaching 30%, if not more, and to still have, you know, such a weak presence on the faculty. Mm-hmm. And then the faculty became very active and had as its goal to try to hire some more women to join our ranks. And we've been very successful in that.
Is there anybody in particular you'd like to highlight there?
Well, let's see. Sort of early on colleagues and had for a while, Joan Shaughnessy is another one who has such a presence among us. She is, you know, this petite person with this little tiny voice who is so thoughtful and has such insights and sensitivity and can bring bring some of us to agreement, or at least to an understanding of very different positions, and who is next year to move into the associate dean's office is our first associate dean in the law school. We've of course had Susan Palmer, who was one of our graduates and editor, the first woman editor-in-chief of the Law Review, who went out to clerk and practice and then chose to return and become dean of admissions, a position that she's exceptionally well suited for and does a splendid job. But I think Sean, and at the time Sean came, we had another young woman, Toni Massaro, who really helped me come to a better appreciation of some feminist positions, and you know, she started the Local Now chapter. She raised awareness in the law school. She raised awareness in the community, and I actually think it was through her initial hard work and her bringing me along that some of the way was paved for some of these changes to later come, and to come in a much smoother way than they might otherwise have been implemented.
Would you be a unique person in that you went through law school here already knowing what your career path was going to be?
I don't think of myself as unique.
But has anybody else done that? I mean, I didn't realize that you came here knowing that you were... I thought you had come as a law student stayed on as the librarian.
No, I had gone to library school to be a librarian. When I finished law school, I really struggled with what I wanted to be. Did I want to change careers and become a practicing lawyer? And I looked and thought about that quite hard and decided, no, that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to leave the academy. Then I tried to decide, well, what did I want to be a librarian, or did I want to be, I mean, I decided that I was going to be a lawyer librarian, but then the question became, and did I also want to be a professor? And that was very rare to find individuals who were law librarians and who were actually teaching substantive law. And I first went out and gathered a number of offers to be a librarian and turned them all down. And then I decided that I wanted to be a teaching librarian. And I was not sure whether, I mean, Washington and Lee was in the process of interviewing, and I was one of candidates, and I didn't know how I would come out in the running, but however I came out in the running, I wanted them to do a full-fledged search. I wanted them to look at other candidates. If I was the one they wanted, I wanted them to make sure that that was the case before they offered me the job. And I also wanted to be sure that if this is where I was going to have my career, that I needed to know that. And they made the offer to me, and I was still trying to decide among a couple of other offers and my mentors, some within the building and others without, said, you know, why would you leave? You're going to have opportunities at Washington and Lee that aren't going to be available at other places, perhaps for a long time, perhaps never. And they like you, and you've liked them, and it's been a good match. So why would you leave?
What opportunities?
Opportunities at other schools, in other locations.
So what opportunities were being afforded
here?
You here?
To build a collection, because the collection, you know, the law school had burned in the 30s, and everything had burned with it. and the university had not invested much in its library. It was significantly below minimum standards in the early 70s, and although we had spent money, it was building a collection to match a curriculum program. It was building a staff, integrating media, using new technologies to improve teaching, the opportunity to teach substantively, which is something I wanted to do, support from the dean's office, support and encouragement to become active at the national level, and I think those are things that, you know, other places don't have that, and there was so much to be done here. The faculty and students had not had the kind of collection and service that they ought to be able to expect. And I think if you were to ask them, yes, there are more things that they would like us to do when we're now ready to do them, but I think if you ask sort of what they think about the library, it's resoundingly supportive. And that, you know, in order to do that, yes, it takes money, but it takes more than money. Lots of places have had money, but not the freedom to work with your colleagues and your staff to build something that's right for the place. And that, you know, that just doesn't come along very often. And it is here. And it's not just in the law school. I think that's one of the reasons that makes the university the place that it is.
Have you ever thought of leaving?
Oh, several times. They even resigned. And when I had resigned, I had gotten engaged, and my fiancé was in research in New Mexico. And although he had interviewed the year before and had been offered a job at VMI, I was not ready to marry him. And he wasn't going to take a job, thankfully, at VMI and move to Virginia if I was not going to do this. So then when I finally decided I was going to marry him, he had another offer from VMI, but it was not in his field, and it was really not one he could take. And I thought, well, there are far more opportunities if I move back west. So I had resigned, and I had told Roy, but also because of the timing when all this happened, I said I would stay. This was the spring, and I would stay through the summer and through the next fall, and I would teach everything that I agreed to teach the next year, but in the fall, so that those classes would be covered and he would have ample opportunity and the school would have ample opportunity. And I had told him this, and the next day I got a call from him saying, President Wilson wants you to call him, at which I did. And John said, and no man in the university had ever said to me, I'd like to come over and talk to you. I was forever endeared to him. I would have gone over to the president's office in the blink of an eye, but he said, I'd like to come. And then the next thing left me absolutely dumbfounded. He said, when would it be convenient for you? And I thought, in all the years I've been at the university, no one had ever asked when it would be convenient. I mean, there weren't any women there. And you had just gotten used to it. So he came over, offered his congratulations on my engagement, had learned a remarkable amount about my fiancé, who had taught at Virginia Tech and had been the outstanding faculty member there. So he didn't know him personally, but he had managed to find out a lot and knew this was the kind of person he wanted to rebuild the engineering department. And although he did not tell me that, the only thing after discussing my personal plans and my professional plans. He exacted a promise from me that I would persuade Bob to talk to him the next time Bob came to visit me. And I agreed that I would be willing to do that. And through those conversations, he managed to talk Bob into leaving the university and me into staying and destroying my letter of resignation. So that a couple of occasions, and more recently in the last couple of years, Cornell was trying to talk me into talking to them. And in a very blizzardy trip in Minneapolis, where I had gone for a meeting of the Westlaw Advisory Board, Bob persuaded me that I hated gray, that I didn't function in gray, even though it would have been a chaired professorship. And I finally came back and called and said, we're wasting your time and my time and our energies because I cannot live in Ithaca, New York, even though I am exceptionally flattered that you would have come after me to try to talk me into doing this. So, and there have been a couple of other times, but there's always something that's drawn me back. So
it's a very nice place we live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is Bob happy here?
Mm-hmm. He loves teaching, and he's good at it. And the part he misses the research, so that sabbaticals are really critical for him. And he just spent last semester at Clemson doing research. The part of major universities with first-rate engineering departments, and of course, when he was at Tech, it was that, but the state has just decimated that school. Mm-hmm. The part that he didn't like was raising all the funds to support graduate students, and that's probably very difficult in this environment. So he sort of gets the best of all worlds here.
I think we all do.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Sally. Is there anything more that we haven't covered that you'd like to get on the tape? I've crossed everything off of my list.
Not that I can think of. When you talk with, and Roy's probably not going to know this, I don't know whether Uncas is, and whether you may have to find out from maybe Lash LaRue or Joe Ulrich. We need some stories about Skinny Williams.
I've got tiny mentions of him.
Red Eye Johnson, and some of those who's, you know, sort of were maybe war years or immediately post-war years.
Those people have been alluded to in other, but I haven't got real
really,
good stories about
them. Well, and I don't know whether, you know, Uncas has heard this. Charlie McDowell might be able to tell some stories about them, but a chapter like this has to have some. Those are the people, as the Steinheimers and Huntleys, of sort of this couple generations. And even though it's predominantly 20th century, those folks still need to be in.
I will be interviewing people who went through the law school at that time, and I will really be coaxing
to get some of those stories out. Because I only have, you know, old records about them.
Mm-hmm.
And photographs.
Great.
We have the portraits, and we've just had a couple of them restored. So they'd be in good shape to be photographed, I think.
Good. All right, well, thank you. I think you've got a lot to work with here.
Well, we'll hope so.
I assure you.